The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Welcome to the future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, "Study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you." At Zija, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. Zija's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the Zija banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
Dr. Brian Halverson is one of the UK's leading holistic dentists. He is the author of Great Teeth for Life and lectures widely to the public and to health practitioners. Brian is passionate about providing preventative information to guide us through all the stages of our lifetime. To find out more about Brian, go to www.brianhalverson.com. And now here is Dr. Brian Halverson.
I can see clearly now, the rain is gone. I can see all obstacles in my way.
Hi, it's Brian here, the integrated dentist for UK Health Radio. I'm going to talk about holistic dentistry because the word holistic seems to have an awful lot of different connotations depending who you talk to. I would like to say that most people would spell holistic with an H, but if we put a W in front of it, you would actually have whole. And I think this to me is what holistic treatment, dentistry, medicine, doesn't really matter, is about. That we treat our patients as whole persons. I came across a really lovely definition of holistic dentistry. Holistic dentistry involves an awareness of dental care as it relates to the entire person, with the belief that patients should be provided with information to make choices to enhance their personal health and wellness. A quote from Ernst 2016. Now, if you notice, this isn't about treatment. It's more about a philosophy. It's about a belief. And I think that this is where there's often a confusion, especially among the practitioners and within the professions, about really what holistic means. My personal interpretation is that you cannot separate the various parts of the body from each other. And so, for example, if I'm a dentist, should I be primarily concerned with the mouth? Of course, but at the same time, the mouth will reflect the health of the body, and the body will reflect the health of the mouth. But more importantly, the fact is that more and more research is showing. And it isn't just because I'm a dentist, hopefully a good holistic dentist, that I would say that the mouth has a great importance to your overall health. And there are estimates between completely academic scientific data that shows that a healthy, non-toxic mouth can contribute to over 40% of the well-being of a patient, whereas some of my more integrated colleagues, especially medical colleagues, say that possibly up to 80% of our illnesses can originate in the mouth. And if we just stand back and think about it, well, it often is quite mind-boggling to think that the mouth can be such an important part of our body. Let's look at it from the point of view that the mouth, everything that enters our body in terms of food, certainly goes through the mouth. And the mouth becomes the sort of first sort of part of the body that creates digestion. It also is very important from the immune system. And so if we look at the fact that that the bacteria, or as we're now calling it, the microbiome, which consists of the bacteria, viruses, yeasts, all the elements of the microscopic part of what keeps our body healthy and functioning, is completely and utterly modified, so that we know that when these microbes end up in the gut, that they could have only really came from the mouth. And so this is where we find that there's a huge interdependency. We know that the gut is called the second brain, and also that many of our happy chemicals that create well-being, such as serotonin, is produced in a healthy gut. So the mouth, by providing and feeding microbes into the gut, plays a very contributory part. And if you're looking at, say, numbers, that 100 billion bacteria are reproduced and manufactured in the mouth, which then are swallowed mainly, into the gut, and that is on a 24-hour basis, 100 billion bacteria. So you see how the microbiome in the mouth can play such an important part on creating that stability of bacterial and microbial balance, which is so important for our overall health. Now, if we look at the mouth as such, we then look at the fact that we can suffer from two main diseases, both gum disease and tooth decay. Now, if we look at it from a microbial point of view, both of these are due to often imbalances in our nutrition. So we could say that from a holistic point of view, that nutrition has a very important part to play in mouth health, which consequently relates to the body health. But should we just stop there? Well, my answer, if we're looking holistically, is that it is an important factor, but not the only one. So what other factors should we consider? Well, why don't we look at possibly psychological factors, stress? Now, has that got an impact on our overall health? Well, a very well-known medical doctor, Deepak Chopra, actually quoted, "The greatest source of chemical damage to the body comes from our thoughts." So here we have a world-renowned researcher who actually believes that our thoughts also play a part in the way that our chemicals work. Is this related to our mouths? Well, the answer is absolutely. Because if we look at, for example, when we're under stress, we find that we get various imbalances of hormones, things such as adrenaline, noradrenaline, which themselves will change the activity and the quality of our saliva. Saliva is such an important part of the makeup of the mouth, and for the health and the well-being of the microbiome. So if we find that the stress causes things such as dry mouth, this will lead to more gum disease and will lead to tooth decay. So again, a direct effect of psychological stress immediately has its impact in the mouth. Then we look at stress from another point of view, such as physical stress. And this is where we can be suffering from, again, tension. How this is manufactured in the mouth is things such as suffering from, say, what we call TMJ, or temporomandibular joint disorder. Now, the joints that separate our top and bottom jaw, if you put your fingers just in front of your ears and open wide, you'll feel that these joints become apparent and they tend to move downwards and forwards. Now, as part of a holistic examination, we would actually look at these joints and see if there's anything like they're moving properly, if they're clicking, or if the mouth can open properly, which would indicate anything from physical stress, but it could be showing signs of arthritic changes or irritation to the joint. And again, it's one of those things, like lots of parts of the body, that, you know, under stress, we develop inflammation. And again, looking at these joints, it's very, very important that these joints work properly. Now, the other area that we could look at, because I break up stresses that can cause disease into three that we've already covered, nutritional, psychological, physical, and where are we looking at how, say, spiritual, which is my fourth part, would play a part in the health of the mouth. Well, if we're looking at spiritual, well, what we can say is that when the body becomes detoxified, and in my long experience, we find that as we become less toxic and our brain works better, we tend to sort of focus on higher things in our sort of thought process. And this in itself has a benefit, because if we're looking at gratitude, love, it creates a sense of well-being, which again reflects itself into a much more healthy body. Now, there is another area that we could look at, which is what we call the environment. And I suppose this is something that for most of us, we can do very little about. We find that we are living in an increasingly polluted world, and therefore often there's many things, especially if we live in a city, that we find it very difficult to alter our environment. Yes, we can look at trying to get out into the country, being close to nature, and there are all sorts of remedies to that, but we find that due to everything from car fumes to chemical toxins in our households, that this is something that often we find more difficult to control. But by looking at the other elements and looking at possibly things such as a diet, especially, and exercise, which can frankly detox. And again, as a holistic point of view, my definition of detoxing is that we excrete more toxins than we actually take in, so that our body burden is then reduced. Now, I am giving my personal views on holistic dentistry, because I find that even talking to my colleagues, they're saying, well, aren't we all really holistic? And the answer is that I think, especially in the healthcare profession, including dentistry, that we all are holistic, but it's just how far we bring that into our everyday practice. And again, looking at it from a philosophical point of view, I think a medical doctor had a great expression, which was, we are not treating disease, we help people recover health. So we're looking at being positive health professionals as opposed to being anti, such as in antibiotics, although of course in some cases they do have their place, but we're looking at working with our patients to actually improve a complete environment, which I think is very important. Now, the problem we often face when we're looking at forms of holistic care, such as in dentistry, in possibly veterinary sciences, and in terms of medical sciences, is that the latest trend is about evidence-based research. And this goes right the way through the system. It goes through research, it goes through teaching. Now, I believe in evidence-based research, but there's one area that I'm slightly concerned about. That evidence-based can be manipulated. And often, you know, we don't often, when we see these trials and what have you, we do not get the whole picture. And the other thing as well is, you know, where are we looking for this evidence? My view is often that we're not taking into consideration is when well-documented work is done in, say, clinics and hospitals all over the world, and we then see the results. And this is what I believe is where general practice has a valuable part to play, where in effect it's the results of providing treatments, and if this is consistent and we have consistent results from this, especially in terms of improving our patients' health, that this should also be regarded as evidence-based. So I have a slight issue with the narrow limitations of what I would call evidence-based research, and then having to use that into practice in a rather less than pragmatic way. In westernized countries, the level of disease, and this includes dental disease, is reaching to a point which no matter how much you put into treatment-based medicine and dentistry, there just will never be enough. So there has to be another way. And I believe that if we can see the changes occurring at all levels of especially training and education with our health practitioners, that, and also the valuable use of the internet, where there is huge amounts of information on nutrition, treatments to avoid all sorts of illnesses such as cancer, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, Alzheimer's, that more and more of the world's population are becoming better informed. And I believe that there is a movement, like in dentistry, where in fact we are seeing some of our leaders in dentistry talking about holistic dentistry. And this I very much encourage, because You can't really look at any form of holistic treatment and then not bring it into the word preventative. And because if we can educate, first of all, the practitioners, especially the undergraduates, to look at holistic preventative ways of treating possible diseases or causes of diseases, then in course it will mean that we can easily look at coping with the vast expenditure that is being used at the moment, because, you know, it makes sense that prevention has to be the way forward. Yes, it will mean changing awful lot of things such as nutrition, lifestyle, but the fact is that I believe that every single person listening and their families and so on, that at least they should be given a clear and understanding knowledge of what they should or could be doing to improve and take responsibility for their overall health. And I believe this is all part of holistic dentistry, holistic medicine, and all the other health practitioners that are out there that can actually spread the word of prevention. So when I talked initially about how the mouth is so important, every single subject that I covered, I could spend hours just on anything from such as the function of saliva, the microbiome, the effects of gum disease. And these are sort of subjects that, as you know, if you've been listening to my programs, have been often aired, and we've had great advice from my colleagues on things such as preventing things such as mouth cancer as well. But as I say, I think that when we look at it and sort of say, well, can we divide it into little groups, then it's a bit like saying, well, should we devise optical treatment away from dental treatment as away from medical health or from surgery? They should all be integrated, and we should be looking at using our colleagues in every discipline to actually help us for the betterment of our patients, so that in effect the sum of what we're actually providing is much greater than that of the individuals that the patient then has to come across. So my message really is that I am absolutely a firm sort of advocate of taking the holistic approach, and this doesn't necessarily need to be, you know, lacking in terms of what we call evidence-based research and treatments that could we go forward, and many of them may well be running along lines that we're already following. And so I really genuinely believe that when we're looking at holistic with either an H or a W in front of that H, that we must look at the view that the patient is the most important part of any form of treatment or therapy, because each person is an individual and has individual biochemical and metabolic pathways, which in fact will be unique to them. So again, we can't have even nutritional advice which fits all. Therefore, again, it's, I believe, the responsibility of families, of individuals, to actually find out what's best for them, open-mindedness, and be given the right results or the right research to then see what is best for them. And hopefully, practitioners that are out there, you know, what I'll call it the coal face, people who see patients all the time, can really be advocates of just creating this almost individual responsibility that people take for their health, so that in effect, you know, we're not in a society which in fact is about, well, we always must take a pill, or we must always just do this. And we're often not seeing any benefit or results for that individual. So I would like to say that I will continue looking at my practice and my philosophy. And I think what is so exciting is when I myself listen and read about the global leaders in these areas, that there is so much new and exciting information that is accessible not just to me or to practitioners, but to everybody who's prepared to, for example, listen or watch things. And you've got leaders such as, at the moment, there's the food revolution run by the Robbins family, Ocean and John Robbins, and the practitioners who they have, people like Mercola. All of these will give vast and great information that can literally not only change, but save your life. So, you know, I'm very much aware that my contribution as a dentist is just part of a network which hopefully has an overall benefit to everybody who we can actually influence. Thank you. Hi, Brian here again. We're going to have a new feature on the show, and that is my friend and colleague Joe Sullivan is actually going to be what I will call our man at Westminster. As we discussed before, Joe has been very interested and spent virtually his career looking at the betterment of dentistry, both for dentists, the profession, and also, of course, the public. So I think this will be very interesting because Joe will be able to give us a regular report about what's going on at the higher echelons of the profession, both politically as well as with the forces that tend to make changes within the profession. Joe, can you tell us, you say you're going to Parliament regularly. Why do you go there?
Well, the forum on which I'm going to report is, I think it would be a little misleading to say it is Parliament. It is a lobbying forum, but which has the ear of many politicians. And that's where I was last week, at least. But I go there because, well, as you know, that I was editor of the GDP magazine for many years. And also, having been involved along with you in the practitioners, Dental Practitioners Association, that we've always kept up to date with what's going on. But it's becoming increasingly difficult to find out what is going on within dentistry. And so I went along to the forum last week to try and fill in some of the gaps and try and keep myself up to speed and up to date on what's going on. So I'm pleased to be able to come and have a chat with you again, Brian.
Was there anything that you could significantly report of those who attended, or what the general thrust of the lobbying is about at the moment?
Well, yeah, it was very interesting, actually, because I've gone to these forums whenever they occur, and it's always been a very effective forum, in my judgment, chaired by Lord Colwyn. It had been until now, and Lord Colwyn was a dental surgeon, as you know, and but also the chief dental officer normally came, or his or her representative, it was conspicuous, first of all, that they were not there, and I wasn't aware they weren't going to be, because the headline of the forum was that it was to talk about contract reform, etc. And without them present to tell us about changes, it was somewhat ineffectual. But also the attendance was quite small. So it was, although I think it was quite effective, and there's some points that I will bring up, I just felt that it had lost its effectiveness because it was really people talking to each other rather than getting the message outside. So, so I was disappointed that the chief dental officer wasn't there, because I think you know that there is a new contract being talked about for a number of years now for dentists. And this is of concern to the general public, because there is a problem, obviously, of access for patients to the dentist. And the new contract they're looking at ways to try and resolve it. But, of course, what's missing is the money. And I think that's where it's stumbling and it's stalling at the moment. But there, it's not only bad news. And, we're always inclined to moan when we're talking about contracts, etc. And it is a big challenge. But there was some good news. There's certainly represented there, and the speakers were from the General Dental Council, which is the regulatory body of the dental profession, and regulates about 110,000 professionals within dentistry. So it's all dental nurses, hygienists, therapists, as well as the dental surgeons. And the CQC, who are now the inspectorate, who inspect dental practices, doctor surgeries, and of course care homes, etc. And the last time we spoke about them in their relationship to care of the elderly, oral health of the elderly. So there was a lot of talk. There was a lot of talk also about pediatric dentistry and the problems, and there are big problems at the moment, of increasing decay among young children to the NHS, but not only the cost to the children. So there are a number of issues we could talk about. And another thing is that whilst we talk about those, we talk about the pressures for the dental profession. And that is very important in whether or not dentists want to be associated with the NHS or how they see their future in dentistry, because there are a lot of stresses there.
Joe, could you explain, because I think a lot of our listeners may not realise that dentists do not work for the NHS, or the vast majority of practitioners do not work for the NHS.
Exactly. And that is one of the problems, because it would seem that, by the way, neither do our doctors. Their doctors are self-employed, but it is far more difficult for them to work and not involved in the NHS. But no, dentists are self-employed. Dentists, and I think we mentioned this briefly the last time around, dentists fund their own practice and they are paid. And currently, dentists have a contract with the NHS. And those that do, because many dentists can't get a contract. If you don't have one, you won't get one anymore because there isn't a fund. Now, that may be misleading. If the fund becomes available because another dentist withdraws, then that money may be reallocated to a contract for another dentist. So a dentist gets a contract for a limited resource, and when that's spent, that's all they can do. So and that is the way that works. So we're self-employed, we fund the practice, we pay the wages, we provide the premises, etc. And then the NHS is charged, or the NHS remunerates dentists for the work they do. And therein lies the struggle, really, in trying to find a way to effectively pay dentists. And if I may continue on that, one could argue that, well, perhaps if all the dentists were employed and paid a salary, then dentistry would work. But that is not the case, because if dentists were employed and they're working 9 to 5, it is known that in terms of productivity, the productivity would reduce considerably. Dentists have to work very hard to make those contracts work, and therefore they have to work long hours just to make the contract that they have work with the NHS. So the NHS gets very good value out of employing dentists in that way.
Yes, and I suppose in contrast to our medical colleagues, there is always this time pressure in the amount of time we can spend with our patients, which I think most practitioners would certainly agree is nowhere near enough to provide a really exemplary service.
Well, that is the case, you know, because once again, the way the dentist is remunerated is on it's on a system called UDAs, which, in other words, units of activity. But a dentist will get paid for the same for a patient if they need one filling or 21 fillings. They will get paid the same for a patient if they need one crown or 10 crowns. And therein lies the problem. Now, which would any reasonable business person take on customers who are going to be easier to treat, in other words, to do one or two or three fillings, rather than having a whole load of patients coming who needed 20 fillings? There's just no way they could complete their contract by having to do that amount of work on a number of patients. So in some areas of the country where there is a high incidence of dental decay, dentists still have to work to the same contract as in areas where there is low incidence of decay. And it is a very unfair system. So you can see that a patient with a high amount of decay is not going to be attractive to a dental businessman who has to make his contract work.
Yes, and I know that this has been on for possibly, in my memory, at least 30 years plus, where when you have capitation systems where, a little bit like our medical colleagues, we're paid for the number of persons that we actually have on our books, that would appear to be a good system. And I believe that the new contract is around trying to see if this system, which would hopefully create more of a preventative approach, could be brought into practice. But I think, as I understand it, there are hiccups in the trials that have gone on with this.
Well, there are, and for all of the reasons that I said, I think it's all very well. Once you've got patients to an equivalent state of health, then there's a level playing field in terms of paying a capitation. But where you have wild variations in the amount of work required to get somebody dentally fit, then it's very hard to see how a capitation scheme is going to be seen as fair. And of course, there is, if one wants to look at the downside of it, there is, of course, one that there be the incentive for dentists either not to take on the high demand patients or to put off some of that work for the next year so that it fit into next year's contract. And then, of course, the patient is going to suffer. So it is very, very difficult to find a solution, particularly when there is only a fund, even currently, there only ever was a fund to pay for about half of the population. So, and of course, we know, Brian, that the population is increasing dramatically, both in longevity and in numbers, because of immigration, for example, that the population is increasing considerably.
And also we have, I think, a population that has got higher expectations.
Very much higher expectations. And once again, if we refer back to the program of the last time we spoke, we're talking about an aging population who no longer have dentures, or for whom it is no longer acceptable, for the majority of them at least, to have no teeth. Now, the average person in the country who has teeth has got, I believe, about 26 teeth in the mouth. And that is the aging population. But the reason they have those teeth, Brian, is because we as dentists over all of our professional lives have enabled them to do so. So dentistry has been successful, extremely successful, and NHS dentistry is responsible for the vast majority of that success. So we made it work in the past under very difficult situations or conditions, and maybe there is a time to look back to what used to happen. But there are new problems. Of course, there's the problem of the aging population, which needs resources, and there are problems of the younger part of the population and children under five, where there is a big problem. And if we can deal with that, we sort out the problems of the future, but we also have the problems of the present in the aging population that have to be dealt with. And nobody has grasped that so far, as far as I can see. That's unfair to say that, because I actually do sit on a committee in London under the auspices of Health Education England, where we're looking at dementia and dentistry. And so certainly the plight of the ageing population is increasing in awareness, and that really is a good thing.
Joe, that's really fascinating. And also, I think that that if we could only start prevention earlier, then it would save us literally billions as the decades went on. And so I think that the as you say, the thrust of certainly preventative dentistry should be really shared not only among the, you know, what I'll call the Department of Health, but also Department of Education, because it's a great long-term investment. But you can't force people. All you can do is educate them properly.
Yes, that's true. And the extreme end of the problem you're referring to is that there have been, in the most recent figures, I think 41,000 general anaesthetics given in a year for children to have teeth removed in hospital. Now, there is a whole lot about that. First of all, general anaesthetics are dangerous, and they should never be given lightly. In the early days, they used to be given in the practice, didn't they?
By Absolutely,
the,
yes.
But unfortunately, there were a number of deaths every year. But that is the possible complication of having a general anaesthetic, and that must not be forgotten. So all of these children, 41,000 of them, being given general anaesthetics. Now, that before they have the general anaesthetic, they obviously have extreme pain. They've had problems of eating because of pain and broken teeth. They've been missing time off school. They've been losing sleep. It's been damaging their health. It's been causing stresses and tensions in families, and it's damaging their education. So there are all of those issues. But putting those aside for a moment, it costs, to give a general anaesthetic to a child, it costs over £800. I can't remember the precise amount of money. It doesn't really matter. But £834 it costs to give a general anaesthetic. So the overall cost, and 160 general anaesthetics have been given every day in the NHS to take out teeth for young children. And it is just totally unacceptable. Forget about everything else. But the cost is £35 million a year for that. It could be spent in so many other better ways. And why? It's happening because of diet. It's happening because of poor education. It is inclined to happen more in the areas of the lower socioeconomic areas in the country. And so that, therefore, the incidence in those areas is very much higher than the average, because there are parts of the country, the wealthier areas of the country, where it is not a problem, of course. So it is education, it is diet, and of course, I believe the parents must take a responsibility in this. It is the parents who buy the sugars for the children. And it is sugar that causes the problem. Sugar in the presence of bacteria rots teeth. It's as simple as that. And it can be very easily sorted by parents taking responsibility and teaching their children to brush their teeth and to look after their diets of sugars, sweets, and in particular of sugary drinks. And of course, to get the child to the dentist at an early age. And they're now saying believe it or not, they're saying as soon as the teeth come into the mouth. And I don't know how you saw that, Brian, when you were in practice, but I think that is very young. But children should be brought to the dentist very early, before they ever are at a risk of needing any intervention, so that they get used to going to the dentist, just like they get used to doing anything else in their life, like going to the supermarket or going to the post office. So that they get used to going to the dentist, and the dentist can begin to advise the parents and the children in how to look after their teeth and the need for it.
Yes, Joe, I was just going to say that my experience has been that I've always made it a point that when I've had a parent who has just had children said, when should I bring them along? I say, bring them along not to have anything done, but simply that, so that you know, they familiarise themselves with the surgery environment. But also, I make a very strong point that if there's any cavities, or I say that really it's a responsibility of the parent, and I'll say it straight to their face, because you know, often I've heard, well, little Johnny doesn't brush his teeth. Well, four or 5 year olds, you know, it's not there, it's the parents who have to take responsibility. And so I do agree with the idea of seeing children early, but not in terms of formally examining them, but simply so that they are aware of the environment, but also so that it makes it much real to the parent who's coming in for their checkup that they do have that responsibility, which they really have, like with all other responsibilities of bringing up children. It's a, yes, it's another one, but it's a very, very important one.
Of course it is. And it gets really back to why is the mouth considered to be removed from the body somehow, you know, as it is with the elderly population. But and also there will be those probably listening who think, well, they're only baby teeth, which we hear said so often. Baby teeth are very important for a whole load of reasons. Otherwise, they wouldn't be there. But they actually obviously help in with dietary matters, and therefore they help in health. But also they help to mold the gums and shape the gums and hold the space for the permanent teeth and to a large extent dictate where those permanent teeth are going to come. So that a nice smile later in life, unless you end up going to the orthodontist, is rather dependent on keeping a number of the baby teeth.
I can see clearly.